And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hi everyone, I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Together we've spent half a lifetime travelling to just about every corner of the world, making a living as travel writers out of what we like doing best. Action Pack gives us each week the opportunity to share with you on the show some of these great experiences and the amazing people we meet along the way.
You can find out more about us on our website, actionpacktravel.com. Also in the show notes, you'll find lots of detailed information about each episode.
So let's go straight to the action. On this week's travel podcast, we're talking to our friend and business partner, Sean Newsom, fellow editor of WeLoveToSki.com and travel writer extraordinary. Sean writes mainly for the Sunday Times, travelling the world in summer and winter in search of extreme action and adventure, all of which makes him an ideal candidate for an audience on Action Pack Travel.
How did you get into travel writing, Sean?
I was a rather desperate waiter in southwest London in the mid-90s, who I got to the stage where I no longer really felt I was trying to make films. I was actually a waiter. You know how when you desperately want to do something very grand and creative and you go and wait tables, and then progressively the waiting tables kind of takes over your life. And I was in that kind of point, really. And there were a couple of sort of flickerings of light bulb moments when somebody brought a beautifully sort of hand-painted, a sort of journal that she'd done while she was gap-yearing in India. And I looked at that and thought, God, I'd love to be able to do something like that. And so the next time, or the one time I went to Crete with my girlfriend at the time, I started drawing pictures, and which were kind of nice, sort of polite little pencil sketches. But then we went for a walk to some ruined city covered in scrub, completely forgotten place, bags of atmosphere, you know, sprigs of rosemary and thyme growing where the amphitheatre had been. And I wrote about that, and that was much better than the drawings, really. And I thought, oh, hang on. And it was about the time that my dad got published in The Oldie, and I suddenly thought, oh, if he can do it, maybe I can do it. And the final piece of the jigsaw was a friend of my brother's who was writing travel writing for the Independent. I suddenly thought, yeah, maybe I can do that. If he can do it, because I know him. It was that thing about, you know, some people I know pushing the boundaries back for me, and then suddenly I thought, oh, maybe I can. And it was a great time to get into it. The early 90s newspapers were mushrooming in size. I mean, we used to have sort of slim journals which could fit through your letterbox, and then people were almost wheeling them around in wheelbarrows, weren't they, in the early 90s. It was section after section after section, and they needed writers. You know, they just needed writers. And I was sitting in a kitchen hammering away on a typewriter saying, oh, would you mind if I went and did this for you? And would you mind if I went and did that for you for the editors? And very quickly they started writing back and saying, yeah, go on. And I was off.
And who did you write for, first of all?
The Telegraph, I think, my first ever commission. I mean, I had no training. I wrote for the Telegraph first and then the Sunday Times. And within sort of 4 or 5 months, I was writing for the style section, which was a bit of a miss. I went off in the wrong direction and then got into travel after that. And I think the first travel piece I ever wrote was about falling off a rock in Stanage Edge. So I kind of thought, oh, I'm going to go rock climbing. And that's something I've always wanted to do. And it didn't go very well. And I fell off. And writing about the falling off sent my career off on the right footing. I remember it obviously resonated with people, and maybe everybody's frightened about falling off rocks, but I was in Lanzarote on my second job, writing about surfing on the waves of the Canary Islands. I picked up these two Irish hitchhikers, and I was talking to them excitedly about surfing, which is something I still do. So be careful, beware, listener. I picked up these two Irish guys and I was saying, oh, you've got to try surfing, the waves here are amazing. And they said, no, we want to go rock climbing. We read this piece in the Sunday Times. And they'd read my feature. Two Irish blokes in Lanzarote, in the back of my car. It was one of those moments. Not sadly, I've not had that many since then, but it's wonderful, wonderful. And then I was off. I made a list of all the things I'd ever wanted to do. This was a guy. I'd been a waiter. I'd been stuck in South London. I got as far as Clapham Common. Right. My main mode of transport was a number 137 bus. And then suddenly I was making a list of things I wanted to do all over the world. It's amazing.
So you started doing them?
Yeah, I did. I did. Pretty soon I was in Australia and New Zealand. And one of the early jobs I did was sailing in the Bay of Plenty, which is right at the top, off the top of Auckland. And it's a, well, I think it's a rather overfished now, but in those days it was just felt, certainly to an Englishman, like a pristine wilderness. And the sea was boiling with fish, literally boiling with fish at times. And we sailed through this sort of, over this glass-like surface of the sea with seabirds plummeting straight out of the sky and grabbing fish, dolphins getting in amongst the action, thinking, oh God, this is paradise. And then the skipper, who was an ex-helm, he used to drive hovercraft across the channel. And I think you need to be quite gung-ho to do that, because they sort of set off in storms and drive in the fog. He once described crossing the channel, and it was so foggy they didn't actually know where the channel stopped and France started, and they only really came to halfway up the dunes in France. You need a certain kind of "we're just going to do this" attitude, I think, if you're going to do that. And he brought that sailing off the Coromandel Peninsula, which was wonderful, except a huge storm was brewing one day, and we found a very safe anchorage up the east coast of the Coromandel Peninsula and settled in. And I thought, right, well, that's okay, we'll just sit out the storm here. And he said, no, we must go on. I found an anchorage for us out in the Bay of Plenty. And he opened the book of sort of anchorage charts, and there was a little map of a horseshoe island called Elephant Island, I think it was. He stubbed that with his finger and said, right, we're going to anchor there tonight. So we set off, me with grave misgivings, sort of surfing down the waves, the wind was blowing so hard. And we got to this little horseshoe-shaped anchorage, but it wasn't a horseshoe-shaped anchorage. It was two rocks with a spit of sand in between. And the wind was blowing straight across the sand into our faces. There was a fishing trawler up against one of the rocks, and that was the only safe anchorage. And we laid out the anchor as far as we could to get as much weight of chain. And then we had a very boozy dinner. And I kind of think the guy was just plying us all for what lay ahead. And he refused to go to bed and sat with the other experienced travel writer who really didn't know how to sail. And I went to bed thinking, these guys are not going to bed. They know something's coming. And every minute or so, there'd be this bullet of wind and the boat would rear up and then crash back down again. And it did that about four or five times. And then it reared up and didn't come back down again. And there was a sound of all the scampering feet up on deck. And we'd be blown off the anchorage. It was like God and all his angels were emptying buckets of water over us. I mean, it wasn't rain. It was just water falling continuously. And it was pitch black. And every now and again, there'd be a flash of lightning and there'd be this rock just off the bow or the stern. I had to sit at the bow shouting to them whether we were going to hit something. And they had the engine on trying to get this thing under control. And we span around in this kind of occasional flash of lightning and darkness for about half an hour. And then in the end, we gave up and came up alongside a trawler, lashed ourselves to the side of the trawler. These confused New Zealand fishermen came up, said, what the bloody hell's going on? And we said, you don't mind us parking next to your boat for the rest of the night? And we stayed there. And I thought, I've signed up for adventure, but maybe this is too much adventure for me. The following morning, we set sail again off the Coromandel, back across the sea. And there were these trees. The sea was full of trees that had come off the Coromandel Peninsula. They'd all been blown over and seagulls were kind of bobbing about on them and looking. Everybody was in shock slightly. And it was the worst storm for 40 years. It was an extraordinary kind of way to launch your travel writing career.
When was the other time you've been really scared?
The other time I was as scared as that was learning to ski jump with Eddie the Eagle. I don't know if you remember, about 5 years ago, there was a movie. I'm the ski editor, Sunday Times travel section. And I just knew I had this terrible sinking feeling when I heard about this. I thought the one story they're going to want is going to learn to ski jump with Eddie the Eagle. I have never had the slightest interest in ski jumping. Never been slightly. I never even watched it in the days when everybody watched ski jumping, but I just knew I had to go and do it. So I just went into the meeting and said, gave them a long list of ideas, and then went to the bottom of the list and said, of course, there's this movie coming out. They said, yes, that's what we want you to do. We want you to go and ski jump with Eddie the Eagle. And so I signed up. He was doing some sort of, I think it was kind of charity work. And people could sign up and go ski jumping with him, and they would let a journalist come along. So I went to Courchevel, and there's a place where they built ski ramps for the Albertville Winter Olympics in 1992. And they're administered by the local council. So the people who keep them clean are also the people who clean the roads and empty the dustbins. And it just snowed when I arrived, and they were too busy cleaning the roads to clean the ramp, the ski jump ramps, apart from the ones that were going to be used by the French junior Olympic team, who are just getting ready to go off to Innsbruck. So I remember the guy putting his hand on my shoulder and said, I'm afraid you can't try on the 10-metre ramp, Sean. That's covered in snow. I said, what about the 15-metre ramp? And that looks doable. And he said, well, same problem. And I'm afraid that's the same problem with the 30-meter ramp. But Sean, I really think that you will be happier jumping on the 60-meter ramp because it's got a longer run out. And I thought, no, that's not what I feel. But I didn't, you know, it's one of those things when you're a freelance and you've got a commission, you don't come back and say, I was too scared to do it. You just get on with it, don't you? So I spent 2 days with Eddie the Eagle and a bunch of 12-year-olds from the junior team, all practicing in the gym, jumping over little hurdles on inline skates. They put inline skates on an old sort of cart. They made a cart with inline skates. And you'd stand on it, push yourself off, and you'd have to jump over a little hurdle, straight up and straight down. And if you got it wrong, if you took off too much on the front of your feet, the cart would shoot backwards. And if you took off on the heels of your feet, the cart would shoot forward. And it did one or two of those things every time I tried it. And I said, well, is that a problem? And they said, yes, it is really, because if you take off on the heels of your feet, you're going to land on your neck on the ramp. And if you take off on the front of your feet, you're going to come down over the front of your skis and headbutt the slope, which was a discouraging start. So I just did it for 2 days. And then they put me on the reception, which is this super, super steep thing that you land on. Very, very steep. And that's where I discovered something they call le trou noir in ski jumping, which is the black hole of perception, where everything happens so quickly that you can't actually physically, neurologically, I don't know what the word phrase is, your brain can't process the information fast enough. It's about 15 seconds of, and then suddenly you get some control over what you're supposed to be doing. And I was in that for another 2 days until I just about had perception all the way through from top to bottom. And they said, right, I think you're ready. And we went up on the 60-meter ramp, which was one shorter than the Olympic standard. And I stood up and jumped off there. The only thing they'd forgotten to tell me was that as soon as you transfer the weight off the little seat, your skis start moving. There's none of this gentle forward momentum that you get when you push off with skis on a steep slope. You're instantly in motion and accelerating. I just fell back, almost fell backwards and went, oh, God, as a kind of thing. There was a man supposed to be filming me and he dropped his camera because he suddenly thought, oh, God, this man's going to die. All I remember hearing was my coach shouting, en avant, en avant, en avant. And I heard this all the way down the thing. Get your weight forward. Get your weight forward. Get your weight forward. And he's screaming at me as I get forward. I just manage to lurch forward and then pop off the end. It's a jump of 11 meters or something like that. It's nothing. But I didn't die. I landed more or less on the slope, waving backwards and forwards, went all the way to the bottom, kissed somebody's dog who was waiting me at the bottom, and then vowed never to do it again. When I got to the bottom, the photographer met me and said, that was great, Sean, but I didn't quite get the shot. Can you do it again? And I said, no. And that genuinely was the most terrifying thing I've ever done. I actually was awake the night before looking at photographs of my children thinking, I've got to get this right. I cannot freak out. I cannot lose my cool, because if I do, they might not have a dad. It was that dramatic. They didn't had no care. There was just a mad Englishman, as far as they were concerned, doing the ski jumping. So they were running the snow cannons at the bottom of the track of La Réception, this very, very steep landing track. And as somebody pointed out, you better be a bit careful of that, because snow cannon snow is a lot slower to ski than normal snow. And there'll be a sudden deceleration. You're going so fast, it's almost as if you stopped dead in your track. And there was one moment I was going down, I'd landed, I controlled the descent of down the La Réception. I was going, and suddenly I headbutted the piste because the snow had, my body had just kept going forwards and back like that, like some kind of bendy rubber toy.
And then you went snow kayaking in Estonia. What's that involve?
Yes, the number of weird and wacky things has accelerated actually recently. And by far the craziest thing I've done since ski jumping with Eddie the Eagle was snow kayaking, which is the kind of thing you see in Red Bull videos. And with some crazy music on the back and a lot of people spinning around, and gee whiz, that looked like a lot of fun. And it was one of those things I went and talked to the people at Sunday Times again, my editor, and said, you won't want this, will you? And he said, yes, that's absolutely what I want. I said, well, the public can't do it. He said, no, just go. And it was inspired on his part because we got great video out of it. But it was insane. I've often looked at those kind of adrenaline sport videos and thought they're camping it up for the camera. And they've edited it together to look as as madder than it actually is. But actually, having now been in one of those events, it does seem as though they're walking a tightrope between disaster and great content. Certainly they were on that day. They went to the biggest ski resort in Estonia, which is really just a hill. They don't have mountains in Estonia. And there were a huge number of people who turned up to do this snow kayaking event, about 120 people, most of whom had never been in a kayak. And they just wanted to be in a Red Bull event. I guess it's symptomatic of a country which doesn't have big mountains that you might think of going down a slope in a sort of whitewater kayak. And they really take into the idea. There were about 120 Estonians, most of whom had never even sat in one of these canoes before, on the top of a hill, looking down a slope which had been laid out rather like a ski cross slope or a motocross slope if you're not a skier, with big bank turns and jumps. And at the end, you finished over a frozen lake. And what nobody really made clear before I started was that you can't actually stop a kayak once it starts going down. So you need a flat run out over a lake. And even better than that, you need to cut a hole in the ice so that you hit water and slow down suddenly. So we all lined up in fours for a practice run at the top of the kayak with our kayak oars braced over these starting gates and then launched ourselves down this run with, because it was a Red Bull event, like 150 different video cameras, drones and camera operators, and I had about three GoPros on me. And for the first 10 seconds, I thought, whee! And then it was very quickly, oh my God, because you cannot control a kayak with a paddle. You just, if you put it down and try and steer, you just spin around. So then you're doing this crazy thing backwards. So you have no idea what's coming up. You keep flying up in the air. You go around bank turns, bump into other people and just spin helplessly round and round, either quivering with fear or in helpless laughter. And it was, you know, it was fun. But there came the bit at the end where you had to stop. And when you hit a patch of water when you're going so fast, the difference in speed is very extreme and you start to wobble. So I just flipped over. So one minute I was going backwards downhill in a kayak and the next minute I was underwater in a frozen lake. The video is great because it's just, you know, chaos and then suddenly complete brownout and little bubbles of I'm breathing out going, what the hell, in underwater speak. Suddenly somebody reached down and pulled me out. And I was standing then in the middle of Estonia by the side of a frozen lake at 0 degrees temperature, completely soaked. Just the water had gone right through absolutely everything. And I had no other clothes in which, this was a trial run. I had no other clothes in which to race. And I thought, okay, that's it. End of the day. And, some guy came over to me and said, no, it's fine. We've got a sauna over there. And obviously this being Estonia, there was a sauna. It was an inflatable sauna, a big kind of orange and brown ball with a great big stove. I put all the clothes back on again and went back up the hill and did it all over again. By which time, because it was just above freezing, the course had been getting rather slick. And after one more run, they had to abandon the race because people were popping off the top of bank turns. You know how you go up a bank turn and you sort of rise up the side like you do in one of those velodromes? Well, if you do that on a slightly slick snow kayaking course, you don't come back down again. You just keep going up and up and up, and then you pop over the top and disappear into the forest. So a few people left in ambulances and they thought, well, we better stop doing that now. And I discovered why nobody else in the world does snow kayaking apart from the Estonians. It's very dangerous. But it was fun, you know. Those kind of things come along not so often in a travel writer's life, and I don't try and put myself in the way of danger particularly. I learnt a lesson about it was 24 years ago in Glencoe when I went ice climbing with a privately run ski mountaineering operation. And it was January. It was for a story again. And I thought, I like the look of ice climbing. I thought that looks like a lot of fun, you know, very cathartic. You get ice axes in both hands, crampons on the front, and you kick your way up essentially just smash a beautiful frozen waterfall to pieces. It's very destructive and absolutely wonderful, in the same way that when you're a little boy on a frozen morning, somebody takes you for a walk in a park. I did anyway, spent the whole time just jumping up and down on frozen puddles. It never really occurred to me that we'd be in a dangerous environment until we went up a place called Buccleted Moor, which is the sort of sentinel mountain at the start of Glencoe when you're coming from Glasgow. It's this big mountain that stands at the entrance to the top of Glencoe. It's an absolutely wonderful kind of shout out loud, my God, mountain when you first see it. And we went up there on a rather blustery day in January, and I wasn't fit enough. I mean, I was in my 30s, I was pretty fit, but I just wasn't fit enough for this thing. And my guide basically had to grab me by the scruff of the neck at one point and drag me up the mountain because he was worried about us being avalanched. And I hadn't appreciated just how dangerous that was. We went on for a week doing extraordinary things in extraordinary environments. I'll never forget the look of a Scottish Munro with Spindrift billowing in great clouds of it as you walk up towards it. It's one of the most exciting and atmospheric things I've ever seen. And I came away an absolute convert, almost in love with my guide, because he'd taken me to these extraordinary places. I'd put, and the other people on the course had put ourselves into his capable hands and done things that I'd never dream of, seen things I'd never dream of. It's extraordinary how exotic a windswept Scottish mountain is to most Brits. It's in our country. It's there every winter, and I've rarely seen anything so dramatic. And I went away thinking, amazing, and I'd love to do that again. And then 5 days later, on the mountain we climbed on the last day, my guide was killed in an avalanche. It was an absolute one of those moments when you just think, what am I doing? What the hell am I doing signing up for these things, which are inherently dangerous? I mean, it's great fun. And I have discovered in situations like that, that even though I am immensely cautious in my normal life, if you put me into situations which feel properly necky, I actually quiver with excitement. But, you know, there comes a point where you just have to stop. And since then, I've generally avoided crazy things, unless, you know, my career as ski editor depends on me ski jumping with Eddie the Eagle.
And then you've tried surfing in Tahiti.
Yeah, surfing is the one constant I've had. It was, I think, the thing that was always waiting for me when I got a chance to see the world. I don't know if you ever saw, or any of your listeners saw, a film called The Endless Summer, which was a seminal surfing movie in the early 70s. It was about the time when I was running around in short trousers and bare feet in a house in Essex. And this program just came on magically in the middle of the afternoon. And my brother and I was about six and he was eight, utterly transported by this film. And for a day or two, we desperately wanted to be surfers. And I forgot all about it, just forgot completely. And then in 1991 or two, I saw a photograph of somebody on a beach in Cornwall in a wetsuit. Somebody said surfing is now a thing in Britain because wetsuits are cheap and easy. And suddenly it's no longer freezing cold. You're not going to get hypothermia doing it in England. So I went off and fell in love with it, hook, line and sinker. I was sitting on the end of my bed in this tiny little B&B in Newquay, just looking at photographs of waves for an hour and a half, thinking, where has this been all my life? And I still go to, for the last 25 years, I've been to the same beach every year. So, but for a time, I thought it's going to be more serious than that. I had a van. I bought myself a van and had the board and loads of wetsuits, lots of different boards, and thought I'd go to Tahiti to surf one of the famous waves. There's a wave called Chahupu there. And it is certainly at the time in the very early noughties was being touted as the heaviest wave in the world because it jacks up out of almost nothing over an impossibly short reef. And if you ever want to watch really, really terrifying surf footage, you should search Chahupu, which is spelt T-Hupu, in Tahiti and watch some of the surf competitions there because it is insane. And God knows what I thought I was doing. I'd seen a photograph and thought, well, maybe I can try that. So I went to Tahiti, left my girlfriend behind, which was insane and stupid, because when I got there, I spent my whole time talking to honeymoon couples, American honeymoon couples, who kept asking me, say, Sean, where's your girlfriend? And I tried to surf a reef-breaking wave rather than a gentle beach-breaking wave, which is the kind of thing you get in Cornwall. And I almost drowned. I just almost drowned. I got sucked onto a reef and hit by a set of waves which never seemed to end, held under, turned over like in a washing machine. And thank God it stopped just in time for me to just get my board and just swim like crazy out of there, back into the lagoon, wave down a passing jet skier and beg them to take me back to shore. So there's a point where, you know, I've spent all my life, or certainly spent a lot of my time sort of flirting with extreme sports around the edges. And I've learnt that it's one thing to be able to write about them, but another thing to get yourself to the point where you are doing these things at a kind of extreme level. And I don't want to go there. Much happier meeting people, kind of scenting the danger in the atmosphere and then backing well away.
So you said that the most grueling thing you've ever done was in Chamonix.
Yeah, that was trail running. I've done some quite tiring things in my life, but at the age of 49, I thought that trail running looked like fun, which is, you know, running up mountains. And I signed up for a course with a lovely guy who's runs trail running courses in Chamonix, and thought, well, you know, he knows I'm a travel writer. I've come from a newspaper. I am a travel writer, I'm a writer, I'm a journalist, I'm not a runner. And I thought he kind of appreciated that, really. And he didn't. So we started, the first thing we did was run up something as high as Ben Nevis, which the vertical interval was the same as running up, pretty much running up to Ben Nevis on the first morning there. I mean, he said, to be fair to him, you need to be doing 3 or 4 10-kilometre runs a week before you come. And of course, I'd lied. I'd said, of course, yes, of course I do that. And I'd done maybe 2 5-kilometer runs altogether in preparation. And the other guy on the course was a marathon runner from Denmark. He had the socks and everything. When he put his, he turned up in these special running socks, and I knew I was out of my depth. I was in a pair of shorts, 20-year-old Nike shorts, which I bought in a sort of motorway service station just outside New York, and a pair of the cheapest sneakers I could find. And this guy, both of them had all the gear, special poles and everything, camelbacks, that kind of thing. And we then spent the next 2 hours getting up to the top of this thing. And the pace was absolutely relentless. The thing I discovered was that you don't, in trail running, run all the way up. But the one thing you don't do is stop. So at the point where you or I, on a fell walking expedition, would stop for a nice cup of tea out of the flask or a Mars bar, or let's look at the view. You don't do that. You just keep going all the time. And bear in mind that you're about at the top of this thing, which is called Le Signal, above Chamonix. You were at about 6,000 feet, I think. So the air's getting quite thin. God knows how close I was with first flirting with disaster. I could barely breathe. Couldn't get out of bed. Oh, I should say, the end of the first day, we got to the bottom. He and his other companion got to the bottom of the run about an hour before I did. And when I got to the bottom, he said, I said, that's the most tiring thing I've ever done. And he said, well, you're not as tired as some people. Some people, their legs are twitching so uncontrollably that they're shaking. And I looked down at my legs, and that's exactly what my legs were doing. They were just quivering. I couldn't control them. The muscle tissue was just quivering because they were so spent. By day 3, you suddenly acclimatize. It was suddenly magnificent. I got a bit lost on that one. But, you know, it was that's another one of those things that you see in a magazine and you think, oh, that looks like fun. I'd love to do that. And then you just, as most travel writers do, I think, you just tend to show up and think you'll wing it. There isn't really time. The one thing about freelance travel writing, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. But you are working all the time to make ends meet. And you have to write continuously. So there isn't really any time to sort of look after yourself, except when you're on the trip. I usually find I turn up on anything that I do in the first 2 days, a complete hell, because I'm just not fit. The only thing I'm really good at is typing, you know.
John, when we first met you and We Love to Ski in its present form, you were a snowboarder. What made you switch to skiing?
Simply two things. First, snowboarding is a soft snow sport. And I'm still convinced there is nothing better in snow sports than kind of creaming your way over a powder slope on a snowboard. It takes almost no effort. All you have to do is wiggle your hips. I've always been struck by the difference between skiers and snowboarders on powder snow. The snowboarders are all whooping, and the skiers are usually locked in this kind of silent bubble of concentration. Because skiing even with the new skis on, is quite hard on soft powder snow. Whereas, you know, you're just standing on a board and wiggling your hips with a snowboard. So you've got the time to shout and whoop and holler. But the problem is, in the Alps, there aren't enough days when there's fresh snow like that on the ground. And for any other kind of transport in the mountains, skis are far superior. The other thing was, it just hurts like hell, much too much. You're cruising along on a snowboard thinking everything's dandy, and then you make the smallest error and suddenly you've whacked yourself on the back of the head or fallen on your face. because there's nothing to break your fall and only one edge with which to hang on to the mountain. So disaster, you one minute is joy and the next minute you've got this, what I used to call fizzes, where you hit your tailbone and the impact just goes straight up your spine into your skull. You get this dull, aching pain as the vibration kind of carries into your brain. And I'm sure it's not good for you at all. Anyway, so I only rarely do it now. Occasionally I've been splitboarding in Chamonix. Well, I once went with splitboarding, which is a bit like ski touring, and that you split the board, put some fancy sticky tape onto the bottom of the board and then walk up over the snow. And I love that. I love anything that takes you away from the rattle and hum of ski resorts. I mean, they are great fun when you're with friends, but they are quite industrial, the modern ski resort, and there's a lot of people there, a lot of clatter. But the reason why I really fell in love with snowboarding in the first place was that sense of just getting away from it all into a fantastic wilderness. And I've sort of found that again with ski touring now, and I utterly understand why people have got so hooked by it.
And Sean, your wife is Czech.
Yes, that's right.
Have you travelled extensively in the Czech Republic?
Yes, I never expected to marry a Czech woman, and she just walked into my line of vision one day at a party in London in 1999. And I just thought, wow. I've been to, obviously, to the Czech Republic a lot since then. Prague is a wonderful city and a lovely city to write about as well, because there are so many layers of it. And you can also spend a lot of time telling people how to do it properly, because it is awash with tourists every summer. They come in their thousands, and I on at moments I've honestly felt that it's less bearable even than the Rialto in Venice sometimes. Just so many people there, and it can be really hot in Prague in the summer as well. But if you know where to go and how to get off the beaten track, there's just a satisfaction that comes from having a lovely, I won't say authentic, it's a very overused word, but a lovely experience full of well-made food and interesting sights and interesting things to drink, which are only two or three streets away from this moving river of humanity. Endless groups of bored teenagers and people with selfie sticks continuously moving across the Charles Bridge and up to the Prague Castle. So, but the best experiences have always been with my wife's friends in Cherov in Eastern Moravia. Things like Sylvester, which is their New Year's Eve party, which should just be wild, absolutely wild nights. Wonderful. The Czechs really know how to party.
So when we finally get out of lockdown, when we do, what's going to be your next big adventure?
I want to get the family into the car, put the surfboard on the roof and go down to Watergate Bay in Cornwall and surf, have a surfing holiday, let the kids run into that vast space that you find on the edge of the ocean in Cornwall, and just get wet for a week, just be physically busy, physically active, and have no physical boundaries. I think that's the thing, it's that sort of limitless day you get in Cornwall, where you can go for a long walk on a cliff or around a headland into a huge vast expanse the size of 40 football pitches of just sand and cliffs and the interesting things to look at. That's what I want to do.
Sean Newsom, thank you very much for coming on our travel podcast. And we hope that you get to Watergate Bay with your family very soon indeed.
Yeah, I'm hoping. I'm saying a prayer. Thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.